Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives. Well, by the sound of things outside the studio, we don't need any theme tune for the next programme. I'll just leap over and open the window.
Media Network, the weekly communications program for shortwave listeners, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
It's the official birthday of Queen Beatrix today, and so a public holiday here in Holland, and we must be one of the few people working. But with temperatures up to 21 degrees centigrade today, who's complaining? Well, as the band's gone by, let's shut the window and start with an apology. Well, because of the Radio Netherlands anniversary celebrations, a backlog of a few thousand letters has built up to Media Network. We hope to be up to date within 2 weeks, though. In the meantime, please, no more threatening letters. And don't miss next week when I'll be giving details of a radio challenge. We start now, though, by switching on the cable radio.
11 till 9 o'clock, you're listening to music and more on VOA Europe.
VOA Europe.
Voice of America's satellite service to Europe has just gone stereo, vastly improved its audio quality, and is currently serving 9 FM radio stations and 17 cable systems across Western Europe, with English programmes around the clock. It's heard in Geneva, Rome, Paris, Toulouse, Milan, Florence, South Tuscany and Pisa, thanks to relays by local stations. Cable systems at Croydon in Britain and Oslo, Norway, are the latest to take the diet of news and music assembled in Washington, D.C. But we were surprised to hear that as from this weekend, commercials will be heard during some chart shows on VOA Europe. I asked Terry Horrigan, Deputy Director of the service, if it means that VOA is going commercial.
Well, I think you're assuming a little bit, Jonathan. VOA is not going commercial, and the VOA certainly is not going out and selling commercials for its programming. We have accepted the offer by two American program producers, a company called Westwood One Mutual, and another company called Radio Express, to broadcast some of their programs, which would contain commercials. The benefit to VOA is that we get some very high-quality programming that we believe will be of great interest to our audience at no cost. And, of course, the benefit to them is that their programs get broadcast in Europe with the commercials contained therein.
VOA Europe is an unscrambled service. Meanwhile, five British satellite television companies have announced that they'll be scrambling their services by the end of the year using a common system. Currently, scrambling of European satellite programmes ranges from non-existent to highly complex digital systems, beyond the reach of the low-budget hacker. Richard Wolfer, head of the Cable Programmes Providers Group in Britain, says the scrambling will be based on the European MAC transmission standard. Viewers will only need one descrambler box for all the services. Software control, however, will mean that the decoder will know whether or not the anticipated monthly viewing fee of around £20 sterling has been paid. If not, you don't get a picture. Back to shortwave.
There'll be more news in about half an hour. This is the World Service of the Christian Science Monitor.
The new station WCSN, based in Boston, USA, makes some frequency changes this weekend to improve its audibility in Europe. The schedule includes use of the new 15230 kHz between 18 and 20 hours UTC, then between 20 and 22 hours UTC, they'll be on 11695 kHz, and 04 to 10 hours UTC on 9465 kHz. The BBC Monitoring Service reports that you won't be hearing this anymore. The distorted voice of the Voice of the People of Malaysia, a pro-communist clandestine station often critical of the government in Kuala Lumpur and believed to be located in the People's Republic of China. Well, it said goodbye to its listeners on Sunday. Although often weak in the target area, pressure has obviously been brought to bear on the host country to switch it off. The announcer on Sunday simply said that the 26th of April was their last transmission, and indeed the off switch was pulled. To tuning suggestions now, and in Guam, the Seventh-day Adventist station, active with one transmitter since early March, is being logged all over South Asia. A second transmitter is currently under construction. Victor Gunatilaka in Sri Lanka reports good results.
At last, after many construction delays and problems with cyclones and typhoons and what have you, they've hit the airwaves, and we are certainly very happy with the reception of the test transmission on a frequency of 11980. The modulation is excellent, and they are really providing an excellent signal here in Sri Lanka. The station signs on at 1100 without any tuning signal. Suddenly the carrier comes on just a minute or two before 1100, a very brief English station announcement about the station, Adventist World Radio in Guam, and they go into Indonesian.
Lagu yang pertama berjudul Serigala Ada Lubangnya, kemudian lagu yang kedua.
That station KSDA, Adventist World Radio Asia, transmitting from Agat in Guam. Well, almost on the same frequency, just 5 kc up on 11985, at 1330 we hear Radio Afghanistan with their home service using transmitters in the USSR, and this Pashto and Dari program is parallel to a frequency of 4450. Well, Radio Bangladesh has made some frequency changes, and now at 1230 to 1300 UTC, Dhaka, Bangladesh can be heard in English to Europe and the Middle East on 15525 and 12030 kHz. That's from 1230 to 13 hours UTC in English beam to the west from Bangladesh. And also Radio Bangladesh with the program Voice of Islam is heard at 8 hours UTC, 8 hours, and the frequencies are identical. KTWR, Trans World Radio in Guam, on a new frequency of 9840 kHz, and this new frequency also carries a new English transmission from 1430 going right up to 16 hours UTC. That's 1430 to 16 hours UTC, Trans World Radio in Agania, Guam, 9840 kHz. Moving to the Gulf area, Abu Dhabi is using 9655 kHz, 9655 kHz at 0600 with an excellent signal here in Sri Lanka. And Abu Dhabi is also heard on another new frequency, this time 15310 kHz, 15310 kHz. The station signs on at 0800. Unfortunately, Abu Dhabi is giving lots of interference to the BBC's well-established frequency from the Masira relay station on 15310.
Media Network's Research File.
In response to several letters, we open the file on audience research this time. How do stations like Radio Netherlands know that anyone's listening? We get letters, phone calls and computer messages, of course, but that's not the whole story. Tom Fickert, head of Radio Netherlands Audience Research Bureau, since it started 8 years ago, explained to me that the number of stations interested in finding out more about the audience is on the increase.
Yes, I think so. When we look over the last 10 years, you see that more and more international broadcasters have their own audience research unit, office, department. I think the main reason is that the program makers want to get more and more feedback from the listener. You see, their main problem is the fact that the feedback, well, there's a lack of feedback, of course. When you do research for a domestic market, so to speak, it's quite easy to find out about program preferences, timing, things like that. For an international audience, that's a main problem.
After all, we're getting several hundred letters a day. Doesn't that give some sort of indication?
Well, of course, it does give some information, but I wouldn't say that you could rely on that by way of getting some sort of representative figure about what your program preferences are for your whole audience.
Why not?
Well, mainly because those people who will write you a letter are not necessarily a listener in the first place. Or they are listeners to specific programs only and give you some background information on specific programs only. But if you want to get some sort of overall picture, you will need some sort of what we call a panel, listeners' panels.
Radio Netherlands isn't unique, then, in sending questionnaires to several hundred listeners in each target area on a regular basis. Not everyone can join the panel, but on the other hand, it's not some sort of secret club. A panel consists of volunteer listeners from all ages and walks of life, helping us to see which programmes appeal to which type of listener.
Panel research is only valid to obtain some qualitative information. When you want to find out things like audience sizes, well, that's a main problem, not only to Radio Netherlands, but also to all international broadcasters, because you have to get into contact with research agencies who can supply the station with what we call representative samples. Main problem there is the high cost. You see, you can't do things like these on your own, so you have to ask colleague broadcasters to join in.
Since facts are the name of the game in audience research, and it may cost up to $30,000 for one question in a large national media survey somewhere, cooperation among stations is growing. A recent conference of audience researchers was held in Amsterdam by the European Society for Opinion and Market Research, ISOMAR. Its convener was Graham Mitten, head of audience research for BBC External Services. As he pointed out to me, passers-by in the street, or those members of the public called up by phone, don't usually know who's asking the questions.
We don't ask. It isn't, you know, I'm from the BBC, do you know about our programmes? We commission independent research organisations to do this. And what the question they ask goes something like this. Are you aware that it is possible to hear other radio stations broadcasting to this country? The question is asked, which stations are you aware of? And they will then perhaps give or not give a list of stations which they are aware of. The questioner will then go on to say, what about other stations? And then we'll name some of them and hear from his or her answer whether they are aware of those which he has named. We call that prompted awareness. What we're interested then from that is whether people are aware of the BBC services or Radio Netherlands services without being prompted, and then whether they are aware of them having been reminded of their existence. The results of that are very interesting.
In general, do you find that the shortwave audience is increasing or decreasing?
Well, it has increased in some parts of the world. Nigeria, for example, and Pakistan, to just take two examples. It has levelled off in, generally speaking, in Latin America at a fairly low level, and in the Far East at a similarly relatively low level. In some parts of the world, it has gone into decline. There's been a steady decline in shortwave listening, or should I say listening to international radio, mostly on shortwave, in Europe. We have figures for audiences to the BBC and other international broadcasters in Germany and France and Italy and Spain and other countries in Western Europe since the war, and there's been a steady decline.
Is that very serious? I mean, after all, when you're looking at television these days into Western Europe, many of the new channels coming on the air, like Sky Channel or Music Box, are quite happy that they're reaching only a few percent of the audience, because they say over a long time, quite a lot of people are aware of their existence.
Well, that's the argument we use, of course. And let us not forget that a small proportion of, let us say, China is still an awful lot of people. In Japan, a similar figure would be probably less than 1%. Many international broadcasters are content with very small audiences indeed.
Without surveying the world, it's difficult and very misleading to announce a total figure for, say, how many people listen to Radio Netherlands. But can it be done for individual countries? Tom Fickett again.
In general, you can, of course. Mostly we divide audience sizes in what we call a regular audience and a total audience figure. One very important figure we get every year is the number of Dutch people who go on a holiday abroad, mostly in Europe, and we get figures between 800,000 and 1 million listeners who will tune in every year during their holiday. To give you another example, we conducted together with the BBC not too long ago a survey in Argentina where we found to have approximately a total audience figure of 170,000 people who tuned in at least once a week. That's what we call the regular audience.
But don't you have a problem in the sense that it may be 160,000 one particular week when you're doing the sample, but because of, let's say, political events or something like that, the following week it's either double or half?
Exactly. That's the reason why I always give some sort of warning to those people who will have to interpret these figures, that it gives you an opinion of one specific day or a period. Things might change quite easily. You just mentioned political instability in a country like Poland or, for instance, during the Falkland crisis. They do influence audience figures, sizes. And as such, I don't think we should pay too much attention to just a number. There's more behind it.
It's a good idea to pay some attention to the golden rules of what not to do in surveys. Graham Mitten.
Never in any international audience research ever use the question, do you listen to shortwave radio? At least if you do, don't use it as what we call a filter question, because a lot of people who say no to shortwave do in fact listen to it, and a lot of people who say yes don't. In America, a study which we collaborated with, Radio Nederland and Radio Canada, had this as a filter question. And a lot of people who said yes turned out to be, they thought it was their microwave oven, or they thought it was their citizens band radio, and all sorts of things turned out as meaning shortwave radio.
Radio Netherlands from the west coast of Europe.
But what about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union? Political restrictions mean that you can't ride round in a jeep there through Poland or Czechoslovakia asking if people listen to stations from the West. So how do the broadcasters concerned know that it's not simply an expensive waste of time?
The way of doing it is really very much a second best. Every year about 5 million people from Eastern Europe travel in Western Europe and South Asia and East Asia. And research agencies are commissioned to contact these people and interview them, usually in the normal way, not in every case in the normal way, but to interview them about their listening back home.
What do they do? Sit around in cafeterias?
There are various ways of doing it, in hotel rooms, in places where East Europeans meet. It's done in a different way for Soviet citizens, who tend to be much more jumpy about people coming up to them with clipboards than, for example, Hungarians and Poles, who are very open, and Poles especially. This is done by the research departments of Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe, and their results are published. They're available from the Board for International Broadcasting in Washington, and they make very interesting reading. Now, you may say, well, the people who travel are likely to be Communist Party members or trusted and so on. It's not always the case. There are all sorts of people, football supporters, seamen, lorry drivers, people visiting relatives, and people who are just out on holiday. It is not true to say that the Eastern Europe is closed societies in every sense. They're not. The results have to be treated with caution, but a great deal of effort has been put into these, and the results are tested in a rather interesting way. They ask questions about things which we can find out about through Soviet and other East European sources. For example, ownership of radio, ownership of television, and other factors for which data are available, and so that can be checked to see if it is correct.
Because shortwave stations are so crowded together on the dial, simply tuning them in is one of the major problems. It frightens away many in the industrialised world. People, it seems, have been spoiled by VHF FM stereo.
Shortwave, if you lose the ability to use shortwave, you can forget how to get back into it. This is why we do so well in Africa. I mean, Ghana to this day has got virtually nothing but shortwave. It's now beginning FM, but it's jumped over the AM phase. Listeners in Ghana are expert shortwave users. They know exactly where to find the BBC. They may not know what megahertz are and meter bands, but they know that the points on the dial where the BBC or Radio Nederland or Deutsche Welle or Radio Moscow, they know where to find them. And they know what you have to do to fine-tune, where you have to point the radio, whether you have to string up a bit of wire out of the window. Shortwave broadcasting has succeeded in the third world, perhaps even beyond our wildest dreams back in the 50s, simply because the domestic broadcasters develop their audiences using shortwave.
But the number of receivers and the availability of receivers, is that going down, shortwave receivers?
Well, it is in some areas. For example, in India now, it's a little bit worrying because there are some very cheap, very, very cheap AM-only receivers available. I'm talking about just a £3 or £4 receivers made locally. Also in the Middle East, I don't think you get very far reaching listeners in Cairo using shortwave because shortwave has virtually disappeared from Egyptian towns and towns in the Levant area, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, because there's good local medium wave, either local radio or the BBC or Radio Monte Carlo Middle East, all relying principally on medium wave. So shortwave's gone out there.
But, as we'll see in a later programme, many international broadcasters are working on new ways to regain listeners in areas where shortwave's on the decline. Surprise, surprise, on average 75% of the media network audience likes to follow technical topics. More than half listen every week. But can you generalise and say that a majority of shortwave listeners have a technical or scientific background?
Somehow we always think that it has been like that, but we get more and more proof that it is not necessarily just a technical audience who tune into international broadcasters. No, I don't think so.
Tom Fickett of Radio Netherlands. Tomorrow, the editorial office of the World Radio TV Handbook is officially transferred from Copenhagen to Amsterdam. When I saw the editor, Andy Sennett, armed with cardboard boxes earlier this week, I asked him whether they'd announced a new address.
Yes, and it's quite a simple one, actually. It's P.O. Box 50558 and the postal code 1007 D for Delta, B for Bravo, Amsterdam in the Netherlands. That's World Radio TV Handbook, P.O. Box 50558, 1007 D.B., Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
As well as the World Radio TV Handbook, there are also three newsletters that are issued throughout the year to update the handbook. Because of the move, does that mean that you're going to delay the May issue?
No, I'd just like to reassure people who've ordered the newsletter that Jens Frost, back in Copenhagen, will be editing and publishing the newsletters as usual, and they'll be sent out at the regular time, which will be around the 8th of May in the first case.
Media Network, serving up a communications menu complete with the source.
Our clandestine column is next, and in a historical frame of mind, we welcome back John Campbell.
I've talked about the history of clandestine radio before, particularly the use of radio in the Second World War, but I've usually kept to stories about the larger countries. This time I'll make up for my neglect of the smaller ones. They had their share of wartime clandestine radio too. Information about it is usually harder to find, but not impossible if you're prepared to visit book fairs and even second-hand bookshops, which is anyway one of my favourite occupations when I'm travelling. There was a large book fair, the Salon du Livre, in Paris lately, where all the Belgian French-language publishers got together for a communal exhibit. I was very pleased to find there a book by Ghislaine Royer, spelt L-H-O-I-R, about the so-called Samoyed mission in Belgium that set up some of the two-way resistance communications with London during the Second World War, but which had an extra job that was probably unique in Europe. This was to prepare a network of medium-wave transmitters which could come on the air as soon as the German occupation of Belgium was finished and start carrying official programming of the Belgian National Radio. The reason why new transmitters were needed was that the pre-war equipment of the national stations had been deliberately destroyed at the time of the 1940 invasion or otherwise put out of action. Broadcasting during the occupation period was from mobile military transmitters or even fixed locations inside Germany. And these obviously were not transmitters which could be used for Belgian broadcasting after the occupation. Now, a broadcasting service of some sort could have been organized by people who started working on it when the occupation was over. But the reason for the earlier and much riskier preparation was that the Samoyed mission people wanted to make a psychological impact and to boost the general morale in Belgium by being ready to start official broadcasting as soon as the occupation was over. The book is the story of how this aim succeeded. Four transmitters came on the air on the same day, 5th of September 1944, with identification announcements that were all in the same official format. The book is called La Mission Samoyed and is published in Brussels by the company Didier Hattier. It has plenty of good stories, like the story of how the transmitters were tested in advance. Evidently, they couldn't put out any explicit program material, so the trick that was used in at least one case, at Easter 1944, was that test broadcasts consisted simply of the playing of Gounod's Ave Maria. Reliable people in many places, apparently most of them nuns or priests, were told in advance about the timing and asked to tune between 200 and 300 meters wavelength until they found it. They were asked to send reception report postcards to a particular address saying that they'd indeed received the tobacco with a weight in grams equal to the wavelength in meters where they heard the signal, and with a comment about the quality of reception disguised as a comment about the quality of the tobacco. It'd be interesting to know if the station issued any QSL cards, or even QSL packets of tobacco. There are other good stories like this, such as the one about a Samoyed activist's attempt to get an order of monks to help in blowing up a German transmitter. If you can read French and can order books from Belgium, this book is well worth getting. Next, on the second-hand book front, I've recently found in Sweden a collection of reminiscences about the campaign for independence of Finland from Russia around the end of the First World War. It contains some historical information that was new to me, including two stories about the use of clandestine radio communications that are, I think, the earliest ever examples of underground radio for political purposes. If I'm wrong about that, I'll be glad to hear of any other examples that are earlier than the end of 1917. During the First World War, some groups in Finland thought that one way to improve the chances of eventual independence would be to enlist volunteers in the German army and give them military training that could be used later inside Finland. The volunteers were formed into the 27th Prussian Jäger Battalion. Before the end of the war, some of them returned to Finland to conduct sabotage, train other groups, and maintain contact between the politicians who supported them and the military headquarters in Libau, which is now Liepāja in Latvia. Two of the Jaegers went to Finland with radio equipment, one to Vasa and one to Helsinki, and kept up the contact with daily schedules on about 83 kilohertz. The purely military value of this communication may not have been high, but apparently it helped morale in Finland and allowed news of what was happening in the war to be spread quickly despite Russian censorship. The impression I get from the book was that the stations were in no danger from Russian direction finding, because there wasn't any, but that the operators were enthusiastic amateurs and were lucky that their elementary breaches of security didn't lead them to being caught. Nevertheless, I think this was a historical first and a good example of what you can learn about the history of radio if you keep your eyes open when you're visiting foreign second-hand bookshops.
Right, after thanking David Ward and Lou Josephs for help with background research this time, I'm off to join the celebrations between the showers. Have a nice weekend.
Media Network, copyright Radio Netherlands, 1987.
I've been doing some listening between 3 and 30 megawatts. It's, some people get static, some people get far off countries. I just get a headache.
Serving the universe from Flevo, Radio Netherlands, with relays in Russia, Bonaire, and Madagascar. Any questions?
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
This is PCJ Radio.